Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Thank you for tuning in. Chase and Sarah here. We don't often say our names and who we are, but that is who is coming to you through the headphones.
This is us.
Yeah. I mean, when is the last time? I always wonder that. Like, if you've been listening for a while, you know a little bit about us. But if not, why don't we tell our listeners?
Yeah.
We should do that.
We should.
Okay, go.
Now?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, like you said, Chase and Sarah, we have a daughter, Stella. She is 3. We live in Costa Rica. We started this podcast 5 years ago to get premarital advice because there was nothing out there that offered, or no other podcasts out there that offered.
They offered it. We just didn't like them.
Right.
So we started our own.
Yeah, I guess. No, that's exactly true. There were options out there, but not what we were looking for. So we decided to create our own. And 5 years later, here we are.
Yeah. And we've been together for 10 years.
Yes.
Which is crazy.
I know.
Decade.
It's almost our... Oh, no, wait. It just was our 10 years.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Just was. I was like, I was 22 when we met.
I know.
I feel like...
Little baby.
Yeah, like such a kid. It's incredible.
Because we're so old now.
Yeah. Well, and now we're coming up on episode 200.
Yes. And
so thankful for you guys tuning in.
This actually might be 200. I don't know. I know.
Well, if this is 200, we need to re-record the intro.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure.
This can't be 200.
No, this can't be 200.
Okay.
Maybe
whatever
after 200
is.
200 plus is what this
one is. It's
going
to be something. Yeah. Go back and listen to 200, and we will have done an incredible introduction, something
yes.
very special with some music. I mean, that's a big deal.
It is. 200 is...
It's like...
It's a lot of interviews.
It's like our daughter's first haircut. Like
Which she hasn't happened yet.
She hasn't had a haircut, and I think it's a pretty big deal. And Sarah's like, whatever, let's just cut her hair, and I want to be there. And I say, I want to be there. And Sarah's like, it's not that big of a deal. I'm like, yeah, it is. In the same way that episode 200 is a very big deal.
I know. You are right. It is a big deal regarding the haircut.
I'm not trying to be right. Some people don't care.
I know.
Anyways, we'll do a podcast episode on parenting and agreeing upon...
When to cut their child's hair.
No, just what to do with your kid. That could be one of the themes. So anyways, now that you know our brief history for now, we'll have to do like little updates, little factoids about our relationship.
Yeah.
Like, we went to Peru for 2 months when we had been dating for
barely three months.
And that was a whole thing.
That's what hooked you, right?
Huh?
That's what hooked you, right?
Yeah, you survived that. We both survived it. And I mean, I wouldn't say hooked me, but it was like, okay, we can get through that.
This chick's cool.
It's okay. We can hang out some more. And here we are now, still trying to improve our relationship and interview great guests like we have today. And that is Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar, who has taught the largest course at Harvard, positive psychology, and then the third largest, the psychology of leadership. So people want to hear what he has to say, and you guys are too. And he is also an author and the co-founder of the Happiness Studies Academy, and as I mentioned, the author of 6 books, including international bestsellers, Happier and Being Happy. So who better to talk to about being happy in your relationship and being happy as an individual. And we go over some great tools and resources, and he cites a lot of interesting studies, but I will let him tell you all about it in today's show. And I really listen out for his tip as far as for creating new habits that will make you happier. And that revolves around reminders, repetition, and rituals. So take some notes, enjoy today's episode, and send us some questions. Maybe you're listening. Join our Love Tribe Facebook group, and maybe some questions about Sarah and I and our relationship that you like to hear us talk about on the pre-show.
Yeah.
So you can get to know us a little bit better. And we always love hearing from our listeners to get to know you guys a little better.
Yeah. Send them via email or send them in the Love Tribe too, and just tag us and we will right away.
Awesome. Enjoy today's show.
Today's show is brought to you by our online course, Spark My Relationship. Create more passion, improve your communication, and build a stronger, more intimate connection with your partner in less than 90 days. We've collaborated with 15 therapists and psychologists to bring you the strategies marriage therapists teach their clients. To unlock a special offer only for I Do Podcast listeners, visit sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock. That's sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock. Hi, Tal. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Tal, we like to start our show with having you tell us and our listeners why you enjoy helping people improve their relationships in particular.
Well, you know, there's so much research out there showing that relationships are the number one predictor of happiness. I'm in the business of happiness. You know, my personal mission statement is to spread what I've come to call the ultimate currency, the currency of happiness. And relationships are the most important component there.
They seem to be. I mean, everyone is on that journey in life to be happy, really, right? And we're lucky to be living, most of us, in a time where rather than trying to dodge saber-toothed tigers and find food, we are able to focus on things outside of just surviving and now more on being happy, right? And that's why things such as your Happiness Studies Academy can even exist. And it's kind of cool to think about. It didn't used to always be this way and for a long time. But maybe kind of this modern day, all these luxuries and this technology are taking us away from what really makes us happy. And you alluded to it in our relationships being the number one predictor of happiness. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about that finding, the research behind it, and we can talk about how to improve all the relationships in our life.
Great. You know, so just recently I came back from a long tour across Latin America. And the company I was working with was Sura Asset Management. They asked me to do research before I gave my talks and share it with the audience, with the press. And the research we did was look at happiness levels across Latin America, comparing them to the rest of the world, or most of the rest of the world, especially US, Europe, further east. And what we found in this research was initially no big surprise. We found that Latin America is the happiest region in the world, but we knew that already. What was surprising, though, was that when we broke down the population into age groups, we found that while the older generation in Latin America was indeed a lot happier than the rest of the world, the young generation, or that is 18 to 35, was actually as happy, or rather as unhappy, as the rest of the world. In other words, it was just the old generation that was essentially carrying Latin America in terms of their, so to speak, happiness rankings. And when we looked deeper and asked why, we found that it was all about relationships. Now, it's not that the young generation didn't value relationships. It was that de facto, they weren't spending nearly as much time with their loved ones. They were on social media. And unfortunately, 1,000 friends on social media are no substitute for that one BFF, for that one or two real relationships.
It is, seems like the problem of our time, of this era of the internet, really, is Sarah and I are in our early 30s. So I feel like we're the one just on the cusp of being the first generation just growing up only knowing the internet, and certainly a little bit later, actually, than the first generation only knowing social media. But we don't even fully realize or understand the effects that it's having on us. I mean, because it's all happening right now. But like through research like this and others, it's becoming abundantly clear that these social connections online do not replace the real world interactions. And it's almost obvious at this point, but it seems like we're so wrapped up in a large segment of our day-to-day lives kind of goes through this new medium of social interaction. So how are you looking at this problem and how are we going to tackle it?
Yes, you know, we need to look at the problem and address it for what it is. And what it is a mass addiction. You know, the number one addiction today, and I'm involved with research and practice in the area of addiction. The number one addiction today is no longer alcohol or drugs or gambling. Number one addiction today is screen, and specifically three forms of screen time. One is social media, two is pornography, and three is gaming. And this screen addiction is leading to a great deal of unhappiness. Now, how do you deal with addiction? I mean, think about it. So, you know, if let's say you have someone who's addicted to heroin, you won't put the drug next to them on a regular basis and just tell them don't use it. You will actually get it away from them, you know, not tempt them, at least not too much. In the same way, you know, this is what we do. So we have three kids, and it's not just that we tell them not to use, you know, the internet or to use their PlayStation or Xbox more than 1 hour a day, which is what we limit it to. We also take it away, so it's not unnecessarily tempting them, not making life more difficult for them. So that's one thing, is getting it away from us. You know, one of the things that, you know, you talk about relationships, what is the first thing that people usually do when they wake up in the morning? They don't turn to their, you know, loved one and hug them and tell them, you know, so beautiful to wake up next to you. They turn the other way to their smartphone to see if there are any messages. And that's what most people do. You know, one of the things that I do is my phone is not next to me when I go to sleep, because I don't want that temptation. In addition, we need to find alternatives. You know, if you have someone who's tempted by alcohol, the important thing is to find alternatives to get them to be tempted by other things, to get them to do other things, because it's out of boredom that very often drinking begins. So we need to find alternatives. When it's with kids, you know, play board games with them. When it's adults, you know, go out and leave your smartphones at home if possible.
I find that I'm definitely addicted to looking at my phone or computer or email. Maybe not an extreme case, but that the best solution is just to be away from it. Like I try to, if we're going out as a family, I leave my phone at home, and that's just, and it's easy. And I'm not like stressing out that I don't have it. And again, it seems like it's such a kind of obvious thing, but I feel like there's so many of us that are addicted that it seems like it's a part of us, like in the same way that you used to just walk over to your neighbor and no one does that anymore, but to say hello or something like that. It's just like, it's just, here's how we're going to socially interact with our community or others, or not even, you know, and that community geographically is not close to you. And it's just so unnatural that it seems like that's why you're finding people are unhappy and they're not fulfilled by these connections that aren't really how we evolved to connect. Have you looked at this through an evolutionary lens, and are there any interesting findings there and implications?
Yeah, very much so. You know, before the, you know, what Gene Twenge, who's a professor at San Diego State, taught before the ascendance of the smartphone, people did spend much more time together. And then we could also look at the quality of relationships. So the by now famous Harvard relationship study looked at Harvard students and later graduates, as well as community members from around Cambridge. And they looked at them, followed them for 75 years to see how they fared throughout their lives, professionally, personally, financially, psychologically. And they collected quite literally millions of data points. And what they found at the end of the 75 years, following most of them for their entire lives, because they started at the age of 18, what they found was that there was one predictor, one best predictor of both happiness as well as physical health. And that predictor was relationships. And it's interesting that it didn't actually matter what kind of relationships, meaning for some of them, it was romantic relationships or a relationship that they had. For others, it was friendships that carried them through. For others, it was family that they invested in. And for others, it was collegial, professional relationships. It actually didn't matter. But they had real relationships. They invested in relationships. In other words, they were a priority for them. And they weren't perfect relationships. They had conflicts and disagreements, ups and downs like everyone else. And yet relationships were important, not just in theory, but in practice. And you know, this explains health and happiness in the 20th and 21st century. It explains health and happiness, 5,000 or 5 million years ago. It's how we survived. We were built to live in tribes. We weren't built to live in dissociation or disconnect from other people.
Yeah, I mean that's what the current studies and anthropological studies have shown, and it's just like we've had this wrench thrown in the system of the internet and of the smartphone. And like I said, we're just at the beginning of this, and it's not like it's a thing that is going to end up with our destruction, because we have people like yourselves that we're not blind to this, right? Like we understand, but I think the work that you're doing is incredibly important, pointing out the value of relationships and then having systems in place. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Tristan Harris. He's I've mentioned him on the show before, but he's a former Google tech executive, and then now has a nonprofit where he works with the big tech companies to make sure that they're designing software and their programs to be more ethical. So that, because all these things, the smartphone and then all the apps on them, I mean, they are designed to take your attention away and towards the phone and towards the apps, because that's how they're profitable. And he's basically educating people to be aware of this and to know that we don't need to be so reliant on these things. And I think it's just important work, because they're literally designed to suck your attention away. And it's like this pill. If someone said, you know, take this pill and the relationships in your life are going to become more and more fake, basically, through these social platforms that are not real life human interaction. So that knowledge is just important to get out there and then to take the steps to leave your phone at home, to give your partner in the morning when you wake up a kiss rather than checking your phone is the first thing you do, which I'm guilty of 90% of the mornings. So it's just such an important thing.
Yeah, it is important. Unfortunately, as you alluded to, it actually probably will get worse before it gets better.
Yeah.
And the change has to come at home. You know, there are more and more schools who are, for example, prohibiting the use of cell phones throughout the day, you know, or kids can't even bring their phone to school, which is great. However, at home, unfortunately, many parents are using technology as the babysitter, because, you know, kids are happy, at least in the short term, they seem happy and they're quiet, and it gives parents some peace of mind. Just one more thing, though. You know, there are also benefits to media, and we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, I just recently met my best friend from when we were 12 years old. We hadn't seen each other for 35 years, and we just because our parents moved countries, and we just met again thanks to social media. So, and my sister found her amazing husband through social media. So there are certainly upsides as well. The point is moderation. Moderation. That's the key.
I feel like when you say moderation, it's always one of those things that's, it's easier said than done. Like, we know what we need to do, but there's those chemicals that we get when our phone notifications go off, and that really kind of prevents us from almost doing the right thing sometimes. So I guess, do you have any advice when it comes to that, in terms of how to create that moderation in your life with social media and technology?
Sure. First of all, it's not easy. You know, it's we all know that exercising on a regular basis is good for us, that eating broccoli is better for us than eating chocolate. But most people don't do that, at least not most of the time. And the question is, how do we translate our knowledge into action? You know, in this respect, I often think about, so my background is also in philosophy. And I always think about how Western philosophy in many ways was wrong, whereas theology, religion, was right when it comes to bringing about change. So the father of Western philosophy, considered by many, at least the father, is Socrates or Plato. And Socrates once said, to know the good is to do the good. To know the good is to do the good. Now, unfortunately, Socrates, at least in this respect, was wrong. Not a little wrong, but very wrong, because we know, as I said, about the importance of exercise, or that we shouldn't be checking our email 39 times an hour. But we do it. Knowing that it's wrong is not enough. Religion, on the other hand, had it right. What does religion do when it comes to bring about change? Religion understands, or theologians understand, that what we need to bring about change are what I've come to call the three R's. The three R's, not reading, writing, and arithmetic, but rather the three R's of change, which are reminders, repetition, and ritual. Reminders, repetition, and ritual. Because when we remind ourselves to do something and we repeat a particular action over and over again, and then we create a ritual out of it, that's when change happens. I mean, think about how religion works. Constant reminders, whether it's through prayers or through art or through sermons, they're ongoing reminders. There is repetition. You know, once a week, you go, you know, to synagogue or mosque or church. there's repetition in terms of the holidays. The each day is, Christianity is a saint's day. It reminds you constantly. It's a repetitive reminders. Repeat the prayer over and over again. And then over time, you create rituals. And these rituals are, you can actually see them formed in the brain. I mean, if you think about it, what's an addiction? Addiction is a ritual. It's a negative ritual, but it's a ritual. So the question is, how do you create positive rituals? For example, how do I create the positive ritual that every day when I wake up in the morning, I spend, 1 minute looking into my partner's eyes? Or how do we create the ritual that once a week, we, or three times a week, we as partners go out on a date? My wife and I, we have a weekly date. We have a day when we go out, we meet the kids, we bring a babysitter, and we go out. Many of our friends say to us, come on, a ritual around a date? That's so unromantic. Why don't you use spontaneity? Why don't you wait for that, passion to rise, and then you go out on a date? And, with three kids at home, both of us working full-time, waiting for that spontaneity, it's not going to happen. You need to have rituals in your lives around the important values in your life. And a ritual can also be every night before I go to bed, I put the phone away. Or every time when we come home, we switch the phone off and we put it, in a safe haven, so to speak, for phones. These rituals are critical. So remind ourselves what kind of life we want to lead. Repeat particular actions until there are rituals. Because after a while, it's no longer difficult for me to first look at my wife when I wake up in the morning rather than the smartphone. Just like it's not difficult for me to brush my teeth in the morning because it's a ritual.
This is such a valuable tool to use because I'm just thinking about the things that I've made bad rituals in my life, because that's basically, you can look at it of the bad things. I'm the repetition of looking at my phone the first thing in the morning, and it's basically a ritual, and then you just do it because that's what you do. Like, this is exactly another silly example. Like, I ate cereal for breakfast from the time I was, I don't know, could make my breakfast, like 7 or 8, until Sarah and I met in college. And I just, that's what I ate, big giant bowl of cereal, until I got more into nutrition and reading and realized whole grains are not the greatest thing. And maybe that's why I'm tired in the morning. But even then, it was hard for me to stop doing that because it was just this repetition and ritual of cereal in the morning. And it's amazing, I think, with a lot of things in our life, of that's how we go through life. And if we can look at things like our diet and create better rituals around that, and then certainly our relationships with our friends, family, and our romantic partners. And it just helps you. You don't have to decide to go on the date, like your example. It's like, this is our ritual. And then it just becomes like, it's like second nature. It just kind of happens.
Chase, you're exactly right. And the point is that it becomes second nature, quite literally. So there are neural pathways in our brain that are formed after repetition. And the repetition can be cereal in the morning. It can be checking your smartphone, or it can be physical exercise 3 times a week at 5 p.m. every other day. And the question is, what kind of rituals do you want to do? And in that respect, with reminders, repetition, and rituals, you are cultivating, sculpting. And again, I'm talking literally, not metaphorically. You're sculpting the kind of brain and therefore the kind of life that you want to lead. And we need to ask ourselves, what do I want to do on a regular basis? What do I want my life to look like? And then then act accordingly. Reminders, repetition, and rituals.
So, Tal, you mentioned you were into philosophy, and that was a big part of your life. And so I'm wondering, like, how you look at this in relation to free will. I know this is a kind of a big thing, but to me it's interesting because I have read up on a little bit of philosophy, and free will is obviously a big one of the big topics in it. And it seems like this is a way to, for those that argue that we don't have free will, that you're kind of hacking the system. It's like putting this system in place. So maybe what are your thoughts on that and how this fits in?
Today's episode is sponsored by our course, Spark My Relationship.
We started I Do Podcast to get information to improve our own relationship. We thought at the very least we'll be able to do that, and then to share it with our listeners. The guests are great, and we've gotten a ton of valuable information, but we found that if we don't actually deliberately take the time to implement the strategies and tools that our guests give us, we weren't seeing the real lasting benefits that we desired in our relationship. And that's why we created the Spark My Relationship course. We've collaborated with 15 psychologists and therapists to create a comprehensive relationship course that not only teaches you the skills needed to create a successful and lasting relationship, but the tools to execute it.
By enrolling in the online course, you'll have access to the same strategies and tools that marriage therapists teach their clients, including therapist-taught video lessons with workbooks and exercises to help you work towards accomplishing your relationship goals in less than 90 days. You'll also learn how to detox unhelpful relationship habits and learn healthy ways to interact. You'll learn how to disagree respectfully and communicate mindfully, as well as how to improve intimacy and reignite your sex life, and so much more. Spark My Relationship isn't just a course for struggling couples. It's a course for couples who want to see their relationship flourish. If this is you, then you are a perfect fit for the course. So for a special offer for our I Do Podcast listeners, head over to sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock. Again, for 30% off the course plus special bonuses just for I Do Podcast listeners, visit sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock.
Yeah, you know, so I thought about it a lot. And when I was a junior in college, I wrote a philosophy, we had to write a philosophy paper on free will. It was supposed to be 10 pages long. And I wrote the following. I wrote, free will is a self-evident phenomenon. And I choose to write this paper. And I handed it in and I failed. but I thought it was a proof of the existence of free will. Now, of course, it's possible to argue against it and to say, well, everything in your life until that date led you to write what you wrote. But the point, the main point here is, again, even if not philosophically, psychologically, it is important to recognize that we choose. One of the best predictors of happiness is leading our life in accordance with our choices, or, as someone who doesn't believe in free will would still have to agree, with the perception that we make our choices. And if you think about it, once again, psychologically, at every moment in our life, we have a choice. And it's these choices that ultimately create the kind of life that we have. So sometimes we have more of a choice than others. You know, turning to my phone in the morning, if I've done it for the past 1,000 days, it's been ritualized and I have less of a choice whether or not to turn. But I do have a choice before that, whether to put the phone next to me or not. And we need to think about these choices as each one essentially a brick, and those bricks add up to the path of our lives. So we have big choices such as who do I spend my life with? Or what profession do I pursue? These are very big, meaningful choices. However, even the smallest choices, again, whether it's off the phone or whether right now I choose to appreciate my partner, or I choose to appreciate my life. These are choices that we can make at any moment and are important choices to make, very important for our overall happiness.
Absolutely. And that's what I was kind of alluding to as far like hacking the system of like setting these systems up in place so that when we have the choice whether or not to look at our phone, well, if our phone's not there, it makes it a lot easier.
And, right, because you made a choice previously.
Right, yeah. So you taught what at the time was the largest course at Harvard, positive psychology, and a lot of what we're talking about, I'm sure, seems like it would be covered in that course, and definitely valuable stuff to apply to relationships. So when a student would complete that course, what were some of the most valuable things that you had feedback on as far as personal application of creating a positive psychological outlook in one's life?
Yeah, so, you know, I think that the most important element of this course was that it was applied, and it was applied to real life. Now, what do I mean by that? For example, and I'll give an example again from the context of relationships. So when we talk about relationship, we look at the research by John Gottman, which you may have addressed in your work, where John Gottman talks about the importance of conflicts in relationships, how conflicts are inevitable. Now, why is this important research to know? Because people going into a relationship with the expectation that they will live happily ever after and the honeymoon phase will last beyond the first 6 weeks or 3 years, they are in for a shock, because conflicts are inevitable in every relationship, even the best of them. So when you understand that conflicts are important and they can potentially actually lead to individual as well as interpersonal growth, you're coming in with a much more authentic, real mindset, authentic, real expectations, and therefore you're much more likely to thrive in your relationship. So this is an example from relationship. Let's take this to the individual level. One of the things that I talk about in my course, one of the big ideas, is the importance of accepting, embracing painful emotions. There are only two kinds of people who do not experience emotions such as anger or sadness or frustration or anxiety or envy. And there are only two kinds of people who don't experience these emotions. They are the psychopaths and dead people. So experiencing painful emotions is actually a good sign. It means that we're alive and that we're not psychopaths. The problem is that so many people, and once again, I go back to social media, because they see other people, you know, always happy, always on this perfect vacation, always in this perfect relationship, always thriving and flourishing professionally and personally, they see them and they say, what's wrong with my life? Because I'm not that way. Wrong expectations, unrealistic expectations, leading to a great deal of unhappiness.
So true. And I don't know who to attribute the quote to, but comparison is the thief of joy is one that I love, and one that I have been guilty of finding myself in, is that I think it's just a natural thing that when you're on social media, looking at other people's lives, celebrity culture, even before social media, you're comparing, and it's not a true narrative. And even if it is, it's not your narrative. And so comparing is not going to make you happier.
Yeah. And, you know, this social comparison that we see so often is, first of all, it's natural to compare. The thing, though, is that if we can be aware that we do it, and simply observe it. You know, this is what Eastern wisdom is very much about. This is what meditation is very much about. Just observe this phenomenon. Just look at the fact that you're comparing, and say, how interesting. Here I am comparing again, and then move on to live your life. This is the healthy approach to you know, this thief of joy, as you point out.
I'm curious. Earlier, you mentioned with addiction being the number one addiction right now being screen, and then that being broken up to social pornography and gaming. Is there one of those categories that affects relationships more than another?
Yeah. So, you know, the question, of course, is at what age? So when it, you know, comes to young kids and up until teenage years, it's mostly gaming. Later on in life, with adults and a lot more with men than women, it's pornography. And I was recently in doing some consulting for local government in Asia, and one of the things that they brought up was the fact that one of the things that they're really worried about is that their young generation, 18 to 35 year olds, are not having sex. And the reason for it is because they are mostly, you know, getting their, you know, their fix, so to speak, from pornography. It's easier than real relationships. It's you can have a different one every night. It satisfies your exact fantasy, and it's a problem. Because the young generation, they're choosing not to go out, and even if they do, they're awkward and they're afraid, and they revert back to what's easy and accessible. And it's very much similar to pornography addiction. It's very, very similar to sugar addiction. You know, you have a chocolate in front of you, and most people, you know, want to have it. And the thing is that we need to change the environment, the kind of choices that we have. Now, I'll go back to the food analogy for a minute. You know, if you give a kid the option between an orange or a banana, well, they'll in all likelihood choose one of them, you know, maybe even both. But if you bring chocolate into the equation and you give them the option between banana, orange or chocolate, they're most likely to go for the chocolate. At least most children are. And in the same way, we need to in advance limit our options in terms of pornography. You know, it's like the sirens in that lured Odysseus. What Odysseus did was he tied himself and his friends on the ship to the mast so that they don't go after the sirens. And in this way, we need to prevent ourselves, you know, put checks and balances, whether it's on our smartphone or on our computer, so that we don't go to the easy and unhealthy option and go out of our way to experience relationships. Because while pornography provides the immediate gratification and satisfaction, in the long term, it leads to unhappiness and to depriving ourselves of the number one source of happiness, which is real relationships. Just like drugs, easy, quick fix, unhealthy in the long term.
I love that point in the comparison with the story of Odysseus, because I'm just picturing someone literally tying themselves up and just how it's seemingly absurd, but it's also not. And it's what makes being a human so interesting, is that we have the capability to realize that we are our own worst enemy sometimes, but we can put systems in place to prevent us from doing the thing that we know we shouldn't do. And I'm just thinking there's a deep philosophical argument here, you know, like I said, going back to free will, but just the psychology of that is so fascinating. And that realization. And so in relationships, if we can do this with pornography, with putting systems in place for the time that we want to spend with our partner, for the date nights, for all of these things, it's going to benefit ourselves personally and interpersonally. And I think sometimes it feels like, at least for me, like that's kind of like cheating, and you should just be able to do it. Like going back to the food stuff, Sarah will buy, you know, usually the less healthy food. She's a healthy eater, but I'm way healthier.
Aww.
And so I'll say, for the most part, right?
I don't know about that.
Okay. But
you're a secret eater.
Yeah. But my point is, I tell her, she has better self-control.
Willpower.
If it's in the house. But I say, kind of along these lines, I say, if we can not put it in the house, like that system, like Odysseus tying his crew up, then I'm good. And I'm good at, but I have to have that system in place or else it's game over for the chocolate.
I have to suffer is what it is.
You know, it's so interesting you say that. I'm thinking now, is it a gender thing? Because in our household, it's exactly the same. Meaning, if there's chocolate in the house, I eat it.
Yeah.
Whereas Tommy, my wife, doesn't, which is why she knows when she buys chocolate, she hides it from me because I ask her to. I ask her to hide it because otherwise I would eat it. No self-control there.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is. I have to hide it because I'll savor it. You know, I'll have a chocolate bar and I'll save it for the week. And if he sees it, it's gone in a day, maybe.
And, you know, and Sarah, you say savor. You know, having chocolate and savoring it or dessert once in a while, that's wonderful. That's great. Once again, we go back to moderation.
Yeah, yeah. We'll have to have you back on and we'll go into these. Maybe you'll have to do a study on the gender differences in self-control and in
with
nutrition.
With chocolate specifically.
chocolate. There might be something there. Well, Tal, we really appreciate this wonderful conversation and all the great information you've given us and our listeners. Let's finish up by having you tell our listeners where they can find you online and maybe if there's something you want to leave them with, and then we'll say goodbye.
Sure. So online, I'm at talbenshahar.com. That's TalbenshaHar. And you can, there's access to my books and to my online programs. You know, what I'd like to leave your listeners with is, you know, happiness is very close to us. It's around the corner. It's inside us. It's all around us. And we need to embrace it and take it and not allow deviations to take us away. You know, Odysseus traveled for 14 years looking for the answer. The answer is very often at home, right where you are.
Well, Tal, thank you so much. We'll have the links to all of your, to your website and your book and everything on our website at idupodcast.com. And thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Chase. And much love to you.
Hi, guys. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. As always, all the links are in the show notes page, as well as on the podcast description. And while you're on our website, we encourage you guys to check out our 14-day Happy Couple Challenge. We send you an email for 14 days with simple, doable challenges to help strengthen and improve your relationship. And on our website, we also have a bunch of free resources for your relationship. So we encourage you to check those out. We also have our Love Tribe on Facebook. We encourage you guys to join the tribe and be there for support for each other. If you have questions or just need some relationship advice, we are all here for each other. The group has grown to almost 1,000 people, and we love it. So we hope you guys join that. You can go to Facebook, Love Tribe Fam, and you'll find us right there. And if you are interested in learning more about our flagship course, Spark My Relationship, we hope you guys check it out. We have a special offer that is only for podcast listeners. So you can go to sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock and you can unlock that special offer and learn more. As always, thank you guys so much and we'll see you next week.
You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.